You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up from the sacred to the silly, we look at the relationship we have with the voice in our head.
First, the University of Wisconsin-Madison is no longer among the top five research institutions in the country.
For the first time since the 1970s, Wisconsin's top research university has dropped below fifth place in the National Science Foundation's ranking of research institutions.
UW officials attribute the drop to steep cuts in state funding for the university, which they say have led to an exodus of top research faculty, in many cases taking their research dollars with them.
With us now is Nico Savage, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Nico, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So how far has this rating dropped, Nico?
So UW-Madison's position on the National Science Foundation ranking was as high as number three back in 2012, so that in the 2015 ranking, they are now number six. They've fallen out of the top five behind universities at California, San Francisco, UC San Diego, University of Michigan, University of Washington, and Johns Hopkins in their spending on research.
It's not a huge plummet, but how big a deal are these rankings in university world?
Well, yeah, there's a million different rankings, right? And they all sort of tell you different things, but the NSF ranking really does speak to how much is your institution spending on research. What are you doing in terms of research? And for a lot of folks who are backers of the university, they see this declining ranking as a sign that that something is seriously wrong. That the university is, as UW officials have sought to put it, really sort of trending in the wrong direction. UW's research spending since peaking in 2012 has been down by about $100 million in that time, whereas some of the other universities I've mentioned, in fact, all of them, that spending has been trending up in the same time.
Yeah, let's look at those spending trends. First of all, state funding, how big a part of the research funding comes from the state?
So, state funding is not does not make up a tremendous section of your research spending. Research spending is primarily going to be coming from the federal government. So it's not like there's this one versus one matter of, you know, you take money out of state funding, that means they're spending less on research. However, what university officials point out is that state funding essentially affects the context for that federal research money to flow, as it were, because it can affect things like the obvious one, which is, you know, whether or not people are staying at your university, and according to UW officials, also affects what they call the kind of infrastructure that surrounds the research, things like IT systems and that sort of thing. But the bigger issue that they've been raising is that the cuts to state funding and some of the other issues that have affected morale among professors around the state are basically leading people to want to seek work and seek universities elsewhere, which they say is leading to people essentially saying, well, I've got, you know, X million dollars worth of grant funding from, you know, wherever it might be to do my work. I'm going to take that to another university somewhere else.
And Nico, you mentioned other issues affecting morale. Are people citing changes to tenure in particular?
That's certainly been one of the things that we've seen professors talk about, and that's been something that UW officials think is one of the reasons why they've seen more efforts to recruit away their faculty. So a few months ago, we were talking about how essentially the number of outside offers for UW faculty has risen sharply in the most recent school year. That was something that UW officials attributed to other universities kind of saying, Wisconsin is vulnerable, a lot of their professors might be unhappy, and now there were sort of, over the past year, a lot more efforts to recruit away those professors.
Talking to Nico Savage from the Wisconsin State Journal about a drop in rankings for UW-Madison among research institutions and how much money is spent on research. Nico, you heard or you mentioned what UW officials were saying, UW-Madison officials, about state support, changes to state law. What have you heard from state officials in response?
So Governor Scott Walker has sort of sought to downplay the falling ranking. Spokesman told me that UW-Madison remains a research powerhouse, as he put it. Also cited a different ranking, this one from U.S. News and World Report, which ranked UW-Madison 10th among public institutions this year after it ranked at 11th the previous year, so that's a ranking in which UW-Madison is rising. And the governor says, as we go into this next budget, that he is planning on putting more money into the UW system. He says he'll be including in his budget proposal new funding that will be tied to performance and certain metrics that have not yet been specified, that we're still waiting to kind of find out the details about. But if you're UW, the encouraging news is that right now the talk is not about cuts, it's about new funding, but obviously a lot of questions as far as how much that funding is going to be and what it's going to be based on.
In the research world, are people a little leery of UW-Madison now looking at changes that have happened here, and either people who are here now saying, maybe I'm open to taking my research funding and going elsewhere, people elsewhere being less prone to come here? Is there a sense of that?
Yeah, it's one of those things that's sort of hard to it's hard to exactly quantify, right? Because if you're a professor and you're looking at going somewhere else, are you leaving because of the climate in Wisconsin, or are you leaving because maybe there's a better salary offer, there's more research resources, basically staff funding that's being offered to you from that other institution? If you're someone who decides not to come to UW, are you considering another job offer somewhere that's making a more appealing offer? However, we have heard from some professors, and again, we still don't really know what the sense is among the majority of professors who've left, but I've heard from professors who said, I've been offered more money before, and even one who told me that, I was offered a matching counteroffer from UW-Madison where they said, I'll pay you the same amount of money, and she decided that she didn't want to stay at UW-Madison. So it's sort of hard to tell, but certainly we have seen in several kind of anecdotal cases that has happened.
For people outside of this debate directly, people who aren't policymakers, aren't involved with the university, what is at stake for Wisconsin to have this high-profile research university? Are we hearing the case being made from UW-Madison that, hey, this benefits people when we have this high research funding? It hurts the state if we lose it?
Certainly, that's been a big piece of their message. I mean, it's not too often you see a university put out a press release about the fact that it's falling in a ranking, right? You expect them to do that when they're doing better, not when they're doing worse. But what UW is trying to make the case of right now is that the having a well-funded public higher education system is something that's good for everybody in the state. UW officials cite statistics about sort of the return on investment and the economic activity that's generated by the UW system. They're really trying to drive home that UW affects people's lives in a positive way. We're seeing that with a new ad campaign that UW-Madison has, and that's certainly going to be a big piece of their lobbying as we get into the budget debate over the next few months.
And I'm sure we'll talk to you about that when the time comes. Nico,
definitely.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nico Savage, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at how a Donald Trump presidency could affect the environment.
First, most of us have a voice in our heads. The voice encourages us, makes us laugh, or specializes in random observations. Sometimes the voices scare us or urge us to take action.
Our next guest is fascinated with those inner voices and the role they play in human thought, from saints like Joan of Arc to the guy on the bus who just burst out laughing for no apparent reason.
Charles Fernyhough joins us now. He's a writer and psychologist, also the author of the book The Voices Within, The History and Science of How We Talk to Ourselves. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, can you tell us how you first got interested in figuring out what's going on with the voice, that internal voice that we have inside our head?
I started out as a developmental psychologist, so I was interested in how young children start to use language to control their own behavior, to think out loud. So I was watching these young kids talking to themselves out loud, and it got me interested in a theory about how our regular inner speech comes about. So the idea is that the stuff that we do when we're lying in the bath or walking to work or preparing food in the kitchen, the stuff that goes on silently in our heads, the idea is that's a version of the stuff we used to do out loud as kids. And if you walk into any preschool, watch some kids playing with their toys, you'll hear them jabbering away to themselves. That's really the kind of origin of our internal inner speech.
So you're calling it inner speech. Do you think it always manifests as kind of a voice, that if we listen carefully enough, it would actually be sort of like a voice talking? Or is it more complex than that?
That's what many people say. Many people report a kind of internal voice going on. I would say it's voices. I'd say it's in the plural. I'd say these are voices in dialogue, and that's that's a result of the way that this stuff develops in childhood. We talk to other people out loud. We start to talk to ourselves out loud, and then we do it all internally. So I'd say it's the voices in the head that we should be interested in.
So a lot of us, we hear something, a phrase like voices in the head, and immediately we think, we're talking about mental illness here, something like schizophrenia. And it sounds like you're saying that they don't necessarily go hand in hand.
Well, it's a really interesting comparison to make. On the one hand, you've got this regular inner speech, the ordinary conversations that we're having with ourselves a lot of the time. On the other hand, you've got this quite unusual experience of hearing voices when there's no one around. And you're quite right, this is usually associated with severe mental illness such as schizophrenia. And around 70% of people with schizophrenia will hear voices. But so do people with many other psychiatric diagnoses, everything from eating disorders to post-traumatic stress disorder. And crucially, there's a small proportion of the population who quite regularly hear voices but are not mentally ill. And if you extend it even further to asking about sort of one-off or fleeting experiences of hearing a voice, a lot of us will have had that experience at some time in our lives. So what's the connection? There's a very obvious difference when I think about my own inner speech. I kind of have a feeling that it's me speaking. I kind of feel that I own that inner voice. But somebody who's hearing voices, particularly somebody who's troubled by hearing voices, distressing voices, will not feel that it's them in the same way. That will feel as if it's coming from somewhere else, from some other entity. We have quite a neat theory to explain how the two things fit together. So the idea is that if somebody who's hearing a voice, what they're actually doing is producing some inner speech. They are talking to themselves, but for some reason, they don't recognize that it's them who's doing the talking. And there's some evidence from psychology to back up that model. There's some evidence from neuroscience as well. But it's probably too simplistic. There must be other things going on in hearing voices.
That's an interesting thought. I mean, you talk about a story you went through yourself. You were on the subway and you had a completely unsummoned thought about strange pieces of cheese at a particular arena, and you burst out laughing. It's interesting because it almost seems like that voice was acting independently from you, but you're also saying, you just said, that we produce our own voices. So how do those two things correlate?
Inner speech is much more complicated, I think, than we used to assume. It used to be thought that inner speech was just the kind of voice of thought, and it's always sort of us speaking, producing this, you know, endless utterance that accompanies our actions. Actually, inner speech seems to be made up of lots of different kinds of speech, voices in dialogue, voices performing different functions. So sometimes our inner voices are there to regulate our behavior, to help us to think things through. Other times they're there to express emotions. And I think as a result of that, our inner voices can sometimes surprise us. You know, words can come into our head that we don't know where they came from. They can be creative thoughts, they can be funny thoughts, and so on. But I'd still say there's the difference between somebody who's distressed by hearing voices, where it really doesn't feel like them who's done the talking or the thinking.
I want to go back to some of your work with children and that inner voice that you're talking about. I've always wondered if it's necessary to have words to think. I mean, it seems like, you know, young children, for example, clearly have inner lives and thoughts and feelings, but they don't have that voice. So what's sort of the bridge between that state where you can sort of think without words and actually having a voice, speaking words?
I think we get hung up on this word thinking. I think thinking is a term that means too much. It's too inclusive. We should try and be a bit more specific about the different kinds of things that our minds do. Now, you can certainly be extremely intelligent without language. I mean, babies prove it every day. Animals prove it every day. But something happens when intelligence and language come together. That was the big theory. The Russian psychologist Lev Vygotsky, who put forward this idea, thought that something very special happens when you start to be able to use language to regulate your own behavior and your own thinking. So it's like intelligence and language come together and create something very special. It doesn't have to be the kind of language that we're speaking now. People who use sign language can do exactly the same thing. There's lots of evidence that people, that deaf people, use sign language in just this sort of self-regulatory way. Do they do their thinking in sign, both internally and externally?
Is there any evidence that there are adults, you know, who sort of choose a non-normative way of thinking? In other words, not with words, even though they could choose to do that, or they don't necessarily have other options that are more dominant, but they choose not to sort of think in words, in that voice.
Well, I think people differ. I mean, whether it's a matter of conscious choice or not, I think people differ hugely. And I've done some work with people who don't seem to do very much inner speech at all. I don't think inner speech is for everyone, but I think a lot of people do it, and I think a lot of people do it a lot of the time. And so it's an important part of our psychology that we need to try and understand.
There's some research about how these mental voices, these inner voices, affect our performance because it can be a positive force. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that self-talk, whether it's internal or out loud, is extremely beneficial in all sorts of contexts. An obvious one is sports, a sporting context. You often see sports players talking to themselves out loud on the court or in the arena. But we also know from psychology experiments that talking to yourself in your head or out loud can help you in all sorts of ways. It can help you to keep focused on a task. It can help you with basic cognitive abilities like categorizing, you know, pictures, for example. It can help you think about other people's minds. There seems to be a whole load of different ways in which talking to yourself in your head is beneficial.
We're talking right now with author Charles Fernyhough. He's a writer and psychologist, and his new book is called The Voices Within, The History and Science of How We Talk to Ourselves. And one avenue that you did some research in is the saints. And these are people who often, it seemed like, had these mystical experiences and thought that they heard voices or did hear voices. And it was sort of what made them saints, what gave them these mystical experiences. What did you come to understand about that?
As I say, I started off in this topic thinking about children, then starting to think about adults in a speech. But from a perspective of psychology, I soon came to realize that we needed something bigger than that. We needed to think about these experiences, both the typical and the more unusual ones, from a much broader range of perspectives. So I was interested in bringing in the humanities. I was interested in what literature and theology and philosophy had to tell us about these topics. And when you cross over to theology and spirituality, you find plenty of people having experiences that in some ways look quite similar, hearing the voice of God, hearing the voice of spiritual entities. And so research is starting to say, well, what's that like? How is it different, if at all, from the experience of somebody who's hearing a distressing voice in a psychiatric context? There are some similarities, there are some differences, but I found it really instructive. I've got a particular interest in two early 15th century mystics, Julian of Norwich and Marjorie Kemp, who wrote in detail about their experiences of hearing the voice of God, who actually met and created what I like to think of as the world's first hearing voices group 600 years ago. They had plenty to say about this experience that still resonates for us now, in particular showing the variety of the experience. Sometimes hearing the voice of God, or hearing any voice, in fact, is something external. It's something that's very clear. It's as if there's another person in the room with you. At other times, it's something that's much more nuanced and ephemeral. It can be much more like a cross between a spoken voice and a thought. And we find this variety in these extraordinarily rich writings from different spiritual traditions.
What did they say about how you should relate to these inner voices, or in their case, if they're hearing a voice sort of like it's coming from a separate place in the room, about how you can go about life and exist with those voices?
If we're talking about heard voices, then as I say, they can be extremely distressing. They can cause all sorts of problems for people, and that can't be. We need to be very clear about how upsetting these experiences can be. The great thing is there is help out there. There is information out there. For example, Hearing Voices Network USA has a website where you can find out about nearby hearing voices groups. And our project, Hearing the Voice, has a set of frequently asked questions on our website where you can get some really useful information about hearing voices.
You also look into the inner voice that we hear when we're reading, either, probably silently, and we have this narrator reading, and it's a voice in our head. What did you find out about how we process that voice?
I remember being asked as a child by a teacher, when you were reading a novel, do you hear the voices of the characters sounding out in your head? And I said, yes, I did. I felt I had this experience of these voices resonating. So we wanted to find out more about that. So in collaboration with a British newspaper, we asked a large sample of readers, keen readers of fiction, what that experience is actually like. And something like one in seven of our respondents said that the voices that resonated in their heads as they were reading were as clear as if there'd been someone in the room with them. Mm. We've also done some work with writers. So writers often say they have to hear the voices of their characters before they can write the book. So we did the same thing with writers. We said to them, okay, what's that experience actually like? And it's really fascinating. Many writers say it's not as if the characters actually talk to them, the writer. It's more a sense of overhearing something or of eavesdropping on a conversation. It's like you're kind of tuning in to what your characters are saying, but you're keeping yourself out of the picture.
What I notice is that the voices in my head are not anything that I can reproduce if I try to read it out loud. You know, I'm thinking about the Harry Potter books, so there's so many rich voices in that series, but if you try to read them out loud, at least me, it doesn't translate.
Well, people will differ hugely in this respect. But it's not just about their voices resonating. There are some really interesting other things that go on. So we've described in our paper on this topic that sometimes people get the feeling of taking on the voice of a character, and even when they put the book down and go out into the street or go about their daily business, it's like the voice of the character is still with them and helping them to see the world and commenting and narrating on what they're seeing as they move through the world. Mm. Fascinating stuff that resonates for me from my experience as a reader, but we're just starting to do the first scientific work on it.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Charles Fernyhough. He's a writer and a psychologist and the author of the new book we were talking about there. It's called The Voices Within, The History and Science of How We Talk to Ourselves.
I want to go read some fiction now because when I think about it, I'm not sure how that works for me. I don't know if I'm really audibilizing what I'm reading in my brains or hearing the voices. And now I'll be like thinking about it.
Right. And I think when you think about it, you notice it. But if you don't, you never notice it.
But then is it really there if I'm not? Anyway,
I don't know.
Philosophical here. Coming up, we'll talk to an environmental reporter about how President-elect Donald Trump might change environmental policy here in the United States. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. This week, Latino USA visits a Native American reservation in the western United States that has a substantial Mexican-American population as well. They'll look at the connections and tensions between the two communities. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, a look at how a Donald Trump presidency could affect the environment. Trump had a lot to say during his campaign. Here's a clip from an interview he did with the Miami Herald in August.
Well, I'm not a big believer in man-made climate change. There could be some impact, but I don't believe it's a devastating impact. I am a huge believer in clean water and clean air, crystal clean water and air. I'm a very big believer in that, and we have a lot to do with that, keeping our water clean, keeping our air clean.
During the campaign, Trump also vowed to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency. He said he would kill the Clean Power Plan, a set of rules to reduce emissions from power plants, and several of the people in key positions in Trump's transition team have rejected the scientific consensus around climate change.
Henry Fountain joins us now. He's a reporter for the New York Times who covers climate change. Henry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's first talk about candidate Trump. We mentioned a couple of the things he said about the environment throughout the campaign. He said a lot at various rallies, debates, interviews, things like that. What were some of the key themes that emerged from Donald Trump when he talked about the environment and climate change?
As your clip mentioned, he's been skeptical about that climate change is man-made. He's wanted to pull out of the Paris Climate Treaty. He's wanted to kill the Clean Power Plan. It's interesting, though, you know, he came to our building here in New York last week and told some reporters and columnists here that he was trying to keep an open mind about the Paris Treaty and also that he saw some connection between humans and climate change. So that, you know, seemed to represent some of a shift from what he said during the campaign. But on the other hand, I think Rince Priebus came out over the weekend and said, no, he still believes it's mostly a bunch of bunk, I think was the term he used.
So Donald Trump looking at maybe making a bunch of changes. Before we get into specifics, how much is Donald Trump going to be able to change? How much will be a tall order given what's already in place, what's in law, what Congress would have to do, what the courts would have to do for that matter?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, there's a lot of different regulations. There's obviously the things like the Paris Agreement. I think the Paris Agreement may be difficult to withdraw from if he wants to, at least immediately. It's already in effect. There's other international agreements he could just not agree to participate in. There's one regarding aviation emissions from international aviation flights. In terms of domestic policies, it's kind of a mixed bag. The Obama administration got a lot of regulations, developed a lot, had a lot of them enforced. Some of them are still in the pipeline. The ones in the pipeline, Trump could probably pretty easily eliminate, or at least some of them. The ones that are enforced will be more difficult. One of the things, particularly with things like environmental regulations, is you can't just, if there's a regulation in force, you can't just get rid of it. You actually, because there's statutory requirements that things like pollution be regulated. So if you're going to get rid of a regulation, you've got to come up with another one, and it's got to go through the whole process of public review and comment, which means it opens it up to a lot of fights.
Let's look in at the Clean Power Plan. We've mentioned that a couple of times. This is limits on emissions from power plants. It affects coal-burning power plants in particular a lot, as I understand it. And this is a way that we're meeting some of the obligations we've committed to as a nation under some of these international climate change agreements. Can you talk about what the Clean Power Plan has done so far, what the prospects for rolling it back might be?
Well, it hasn't done anything so far because it's not in effect. It's been the regulations have been published, but it was immediately challenged by a lot of states who thought it was unfair to their particular economies, essentially. So it's actually right now in the courts. It's in a appeals court in Washington, D.C. What it would do is it would effectively require things like existing power plants to either shut down because they produce a lot of CO2 or develop systems for, removing the carbon dioxide and storing it somehow. So it would result in a lot of emissions reductions, and that, as you said, is a key part of the Paris Climate Accord, reaching the goals of the Paris Climate Accord. But since it's not yet in effect and it's in the courts, what the Trump administration can do, assuming there's no court decision by Inauguration Day on the 20th of January, then the new Justice Department, the Trump Justice Department, can ask the court to basically just drop it, suspend their work, and the Clean Power Plan would stay unenforced, or not in force.
And Donald Trump on the campaign trail made economic commitments saying he would work to bring back the coal industry in the United States. If the Clean Power Plan doesn't go into effect, would that be a benefit for coal power in the U.S.?
My guess it might be a short-term benefit, but most people, even Mitch McConnell from a coal state, Senator Mitch McConnell, more or less acknowledges that coal is, it's been dying, and it's not really going to get resurrected. It's more of an economic problem than anything else, particularly with all the natural gas the United States has been producing over the last decade through fracking and other technologies. That's lowered the cost of natural gas so much that even coal, which has been cheap, is finding, it's economically pinched. The other thing is that, Mr. Trump talked about, really liking clean water and clean air and coal. There's lots of EPA regulations that are not affected under the Clean Power Plan about keeping areas around coal mines and coal plants, keeping the water clean as well as the air. So there'd still be a lot of regulations on coal, even without the Clean Power Plan.
Henry Fountain is with us from the New York Times, looking at Donald Trump, what he said, what he could do on issues related to the environment and climate change. Let's talk about the Environmental Protection Agency. Donald Trump has talked about, either dialing back a lot of what the EPA does. I think the word dismantling came up sometimes. What options are on the table for Donald Trump when it comes to changes in one form or another at the EPA?
Well, the idea of just sort of getting rid of the EPA, which I think he talked about at some point during the campaign, is not really a viable option. And I think even if you were to sit down with Mr. Trump and talk to him at length about it, he would admit that, because as he said, and as your clip illustrated, he really supports clean air and clean water, and both of those are a large part of what the EPA does. But in terms of, he's talked a lot about regulations that harm industry. So I think under him, the EPA would, try to either modify or eventually not enforce regulations that are considered to be, add extra costs to power plants or to other industries that have high emissions. That would be my guess. Again, it's not an easy thing to to get rid of regulations. It's a little bit easier, if he appoints a very pro fossil fuel chief of the EPA, the administrator of the EPA. That person could, use influence to have certain things not enforced by his staff. The other possibility, and I think it's probably the most likely one, is to have the Congress not fund certain parts of the EPA, certain enforcement aspects of the EPA. They can do that fairly easily with, a rider to an appropriations bill that would last a year, that would just say, we are not providing money for this specific, department or area within the EPA. And those riders could be renewed every year, so he could effectively starve the agency of funding in specific areas.
So that would not be canceling a regulation by the administration. That would not be Congress passing a law that overrides this regulation. It would leave it on the books, in effect, but say, yeah, but there's no money to do anything with that regulation.
And there's a long history of administrations doing that sort of thing, not funding, and through, as long as they have the Congress on their side, not funding whatever they're opposed to. So that, I would think, is highly likely. And, both houses are controlled by the Republicans. So I would think that will happen.
We've heard hints, statements that the Trump administration would cut funding for NASA when it comes to climate change research. How big a role does NASA play, first of all, in climate change research?
It does. It plays a big role with between NASA and NOAA and the National Science Foundation. All three fund a lot of climate research. The idea of cutting money from NASA, it's been going around for a couple of years. It's been a Republican sort of meme. The idea, what they say is, NASA should be focused on the planets. It shouldn't be focused on Earth. Other agencies can focus on Earth. But in fact, NASA has a lot of, they have a lot of satellites. They have a lot of scientists who look at what's going on Earth, almost as a corollary to what could be going on other planets. So they do a lot of really useful research. The person who made that comment the other day, it was reported, I believe, in The Guardian and some other sources, is a transition member of the transition team, and he didn't specifically say there should be no climate research in the government, and he didn't even say NASA should necessarily not do any. He said, maybe some of it should be transferred to NOAA, because NOAA's, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, their purview is the Earth. So it's unclear, how much Trump presidency would actually cut basic climate research. And, any climate scientist will tell you, we don't do enough of it as it is now. We need to do a lot more. We need to find out really what's going on with the planet. We need to, for all these models that, talk about the impact of climate change over the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years or longer, the more actual data you can get from satellites and sensors and buoys and stuff, the better. And NASA provides a lot of that data.
And finally, what kind of clues can we see about Donald Trump's environmental policies and plans when we look at who he's picking for his transition team or the people we're hearing about in key cabinet positions?
Yeah, I think actually that's, you know, it's very telling who he's talking to and who he's picking. I mean, in terms of, you know, who's talked about, because he really hasn't made any major appointments on environmental stuff yet. But, you know, his transition team chief is a guy named Myron Ebel, who's not a scientist, not really doesn't have much government experience. He's sort of a libertarian who rejects most of the ideas of climate change, and you know, and he's actually in charge of sort of setting up Trump's EPA. He pretty much certainly won't be running it, but so that's, you know, that's an indication of where things are heading. The people who have been talked about to head both the EPA and Interior and the Energy Department tend to be, the names I've heard are all people from fossil fuel backgrounds, you know, people from energy companies, people who've lobbied for energy companies. And this is a big change from Obama and some other administrations. For instance, the Energy Department, which has a lot of does a lot of research on alternative energy and things like that, the last two Obama appointees to head it up have both been physicists. And the two people whose names I've heard are both for the Trump administration are both you know, big fossil fuel guys who've made their fortunes in fracking, in fact. So that does represent quite a shift, and you could expect to see a lot of changes in those agencies because of the sort of the outlook from the top.
We'll leave it there for now, Henry. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Henry Fountain, reporter for the New York Times. He covers climate change and environmental issues. He joined us to talk about how a Donald Trump presidency could affect the environment.
Coming up, we'll hear the latest installment in the WPR News series about Madison police recruits, and we visit with reporter Bridget Bowden, who has been embedded with that class. Stay with us here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. At a time when police are highly scrutinized, those just entering law enforcement do not take the decision to join the force lightly. In an ongoing series, WPR News is following a class of police recruits through the Madison Training Academy. For recruits with families and young children, entering the police force brings a new set of challenges. Bridget Bowden has more.
For as long as recruit Nick Cleary's wife, Kaylee, has known him, he's been a cop. Before he was hired in Madison, he was an officer in Fitchburg. In fact, they met when he pulled her over for a broken license plate light.
I ended up pulling her over on Verona Road, thinking I either, like, have, you know, maybe a drunk person or somebody running drugs. And I walk up, and there she is in sweatpants and glasses, and she tells me she was the DD for someone that night.
But even though she's used to his job, she says it's still hard, especially now that they have a 17-month-old daughter, Felina.
There's like a baseline level of worry that doesn't ever go away, even on off days, especially with her. And I think that's probably the biggest thing, is just the worry that something would happen to him. And it, I mean, I was reminded of it, you know, not too long ago when you were filling out paperwork and you asked me, if something happened to you, who do you want to come to the door?
Yeah.
Just this year, more than 100 officers have died in the line of duty, according to the Officer Down memorial page. Kaylee says she often wonders how Nick copes.
He'll come home and tell me stories about work, and I'll be like, how is that? Like, how are you okay? Like, how can you, you know, how are you just, like, totally chill and come home and put your feet up on the table kind of thing? Like,
hi.
Hi, honey.
That's how.
The recruits are in their 11th week of the six-month-long academy. Since Nick is at the training center all day, he doesn't get as much time with Felina as he would like.
I really love to spend time with her, so I have about a two-hour window when I get home from work before she's, you know, eating and then getting ready for bed. So I basically only really get 2 hours with her every day.
In the time he does get, Nick says he enjoys seeing all the new words she's learned. They look at books together.
What?
No.
Duck, yeah. What's that?
Moo.
Moo, yeah. What's that?
Of the 23 recruits, about half are married. A handful have kids. Jessica Gillette applied to the MPD 3 times before finally being selected for this year's class. She says she seriously considered her 6-year-old son, Noah, before deciding to become a cop.
having a child and makes you think perhaps a little bit more about the sacrifice that you're making in terms of going into police and because of the innate dangers that it does involve. But for me, it's also important to show him as his mother, as a strong female role model, that this really is my passion and this is what I'm really willing to sacrifice.
Gillette and her family were living in Germany before she was hired by MPD. They moved back because she wanted to raise Noah in Madison. She says he's still pretty young to fully understand her career change.
You know what? I haven't really sat down with him per se and, you know, outwardly asked, how do you feel to have a mom as a police officer? I imagine those conversations will come up. He hasn't seen my duty belt or, you know, my gun or anything like that.
Gillette sometimes comes into the academy for extra practice with firearms or defense and arrest tactics. But with studying, extra practice, and family, sometimes she has to make choices.
You know, I don't just, for example, have myself to take care of. I do have other responsibilities, which I think helps balance this stress of what's going on in my life, because I can somehow separate it, because I have to.
For these recruits, it's a constant balancing act, and that will most certainly continue when they're officially sworn in as officers next spring. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Bridget Bowden joins us in the studio now. Bridget, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So going through this class, how big a time commitment is it for these recruits?
So the academy started at the beginning of September, and it goes through the end of February. And then after that, the recruits will start field training.
But on a week-to-week basis, this is like a 40-hour work week, but we're hearing people going in for extra training, things like that, and homework. It's a pretty big commitment.
So the recruits arrive every day at 7:45 in the morning. Some come early for extra practice, and the day goes until 4. And then, like you said, some do stay after for extra practice.
You were talking to people about their family lives, their worries about risks that when they leave and become a police officer, they might not come home to their kid. Is there some kind of support or counseling for these recruits and when they become officers, for police officers, on dealing with those issues?
Yes. So the MPD does have counselors available, as most workplaces do. And the recruits are trained on mental health issues, and specifically officer mental health and officer suicide prevention and those kinds of things.
And is this are these things that people were thinking about, these recruits, or is it as they go along, are they realizing, oh, wow, no, this is going to be a big deal?
Oh, they definitely considered it before entering the academy, especially those that have families or children. From the people that I've talked to, it was definitely a deciding factor that they considered before they even sent their application.
Another piece of the training that you were there for wasn't part of this feature, the pepper spray training. Not using it, not deploying the pepper spray, but being on the receiving end of it?
Right. So it's actually both. They did learn how to deploy pepper spray, but as a part of that training, they all had to be the recipient of pepper spray to the face. This was last week. And so I was there. I watched them get sprayed, and then they had to do several tasks before they were able to wash the spray off. So
they
did that so that they could learn what it really feels like, so that they would know what that is if they ever were to deploy the pepper spray.
How did they talk about it? You didn't do this yourself. I wouldn't have either. But how did they talk about having been pepper sprayed?
Right. So several of them had already been sprayed before, if they were former law enforcement and their previous training, they had been through this before. And so some of them knew what was coming, but some of them definitely didn't. And I think that it was more intense than I certainly could have imagined, but many of them could have imagined as well.
Now, we've heard your features on driving, police driving training, now on families. We're talking about pepper spray. What's coming up next in this long training process?
So in the next few months, I hope to take a look at mental health training, both for the officers themselves and then how they deal with mental health issues in the community. And then also I'm hoping to look into how they're learning to deal with undocumented communities.
Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll keep watching for those installments in this series. WPR reporter Bridget Bowden has been following the current class of Madison police recruits for the whole Police Academy series so far. Visit WPR.org/Police Academy. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.